This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Imagine working in a homeless shelter and finding one day that your father has come in from the street for a bed. That happened to writer Nick Flynn when he was in his 20s, and he wrote about it in a memoir with the title we can translate as Another BS Night in Suck City. The story is now a movie called Being Flynn, starring Paul Dano as the young Nick Flynn and Robert De Niro as his father, Jonathan. Jonathan Flynn spent most of his life as an alcoholic who worked odd jobs and spent time in prison, but always considered himself a great writer. Our guests today are Nick Flynn and Paul Weitz, who directed Being Flynn. Weitz directed the film American Pie with his brother Chris. They also directed and wrote the screenplay for About a Boy, adapted from a novel by Nick Hornby. Paul Weitz also directed the films In Good Company and Little Fockers. Nick Flynn is a successful poet and has written a second memoir called The Ticking is the Bomb. Here's a scene from Being Flynn, in which Nick's father, played by Robert De Niro, meets Nick, played by Paul Dano.
Yeah, wait, so you drive a taxi? Yeah.
Well, it's an excellent way of learning about all different kinds of people. And what's your vocation?
My vocation? I've done lots of different jobs.
I always thought you'd end up a writer like your old man.
Actually, I do write. Sometimes I try.
Well, there's no such thing as trying to write. One writes or one doesn't. And you have to take every opportunity to practice your craft. Anyway, I know you've inherited some writing talent from me because I am a truly great writer. I'm going to show you something. A letter from Viking Press. You've heard of Viking Press, haven't you?
Yeah.
Look at this. Look at that phrase there.
Your book is a virtuoso display of personality. Unfortunately, its dosage would kill hardier readers than we have here.
Virtuoso display, Viking Press.
Well, Paul Weitz and Nick Flynn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having us.
Nick, let's begin with you. You grew up without really knowing your dad, right? He left when you were a baby. What was your image of him growing up?
There wasn't much image. I barely saw a photograph of him. My mother didn't talk about him. There'd be occasionally, on Christmases, there'd be a gift would appear somehow, maybe in the mail or maybe left at my grandmother's house. But slowly, when I became a teenager, he sort of came more into my life because he got sent to federal prison for something like robbing banks and began writing me letters from prison. So that's sort of when I was about 15, I began to know a little more about him.
And what were those letters like?
Occasionally they were sort of profound and kind of filled with certain kind of insight. They were advice on how to be a writer, even though he knew nothing about me and didn't have any sense that I wanted to be a writer, and maybe I didn't even at that point, and just about how to live in the world. But also they're a little loopy too, delusional and crazy. And they got crazier as it went on. He would Xerox a lot of letters. He would send the same letter sometimes to some famous people like Ted Kennedy. He was someone he wrote to a lot, and he'd Xerox that letter and send it back to me. So they began to be sort of Xeroxes of Xerox. He sent me Ted Kennedy's letters to him, which were sort of form letters.
The idea was to impress you with his importance?
I believe so, yeah. Many of the letters did end with or begin with, soon, very soon, I shall be known. Like he really sort of put all his chips into this idea of becoming famous, and he'd be famous through his writing. I mean, that was where his fame would rest, would be in his writing.
Did you write him back?
I never did. No, I never wrote him back. I wrote him back once when he was homeless. Years later, I was in my late 20s, and I wrote him a letter once, and he ended up promptly Xeroxing it and sending it around the country. So I felt kind of awkward about that.
Now, I know from the memoir you were long interested in writing. I mean, you had projects with friends of yours. Why didn't you think of writing your dad back?
It was mostly out of respect for my mother, I believe. There was clearly, a deep river of bad blood between them. And I think if I expressed interest in him, it felt like it would somehow hurt her in some way. So it was more to protect her, I think.
I guess you were about 16 when he went into prison. He served a couple of years. And then when he got out, did the letters keep coming? Did you have any contact or sense of where he was?
Yeah, letters came out. They began, once he got out of prison, the letters became, they came out now on letterhead. He somehow created a fake corporation for himself while in prison, something called the Fact Foundation of America, where he was, now he was writing about his experiences in prison and comparing himself to Solzhenitsyn's experience in the Russian Gulag. And, you know, he almost became more self-aggrandized after prison with this fake company called the FAK Foundation of America. So, yeah, the letters kept coming. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so as you get into your 20s, you're in Boston, and you start working at a homeless shelter. Why do you think you found yourself working there?
Yeah, I began working at the Pine Street Inn, you know, a homeless shelter in Boston, when I was 24. And it was about 2 years after my mother took her own life. And I was young and quite lost, grieving. And I'm not sure exactly why working at a homeless shelter made sense to me, why that would be the place to go, except that I think I needed to be, you know, perhaps to immerse myself in some sort of larger real life situation, so to get me out of the sort of the cage of my mind in some way, and you know, however I was torturing myself, to be around other people who were struggling, and to sort of maybe find a purpose for my life.
And when you were 24, when you started working with the homeless, did you know that your father was then on the street?
Yeah, when I was 24, my father wasn't on the street.
He
when I began working at the shelter, my father was driving a cab and paying his bills, and he wouldn't end up homeless for 3 years after I'd been in the shelter. So
Paul Weitz, you read Nick Flynn's memoir about his experiences. What made you want to adapt it for a film?
Aside from the beautiful poetic details of the story and its presentation in the book, it boiled down to a couple of themes which were really central to me. One of which was whether we're fated to become our parents, and eventually how much of their flaws do we have to own in order to move on with our lives. And the second of which was the relation between creativity and ego, in that it's about Nick's father, Jonathan Flynn, played by Robert De Niro, states in the beginning of the movie that he's one of three great writers that America has produced, Mark Twain, J.D. Salinger, and Jonathan Flynn. He had this vision of himself as a great artist, and while that ego must have consumed him in some way, also it was interesting to me that Nick later on said that that sense of self and differentiation from the people who he was eventually living with in the shelter probably is what helped him survive and not end up either living in a shelter permanently or dying out on the street.
Robert De Niro plays Nick's father, Jonathan Flynn, in this film. Paul Weitz, how did De Niro get involved with this project?
He got involved very early on and then stuck with the film over the course of 6 or 7 years when it was sort of bouncing from studio to studio. His attitude towards the film was so pure, I feel, throughout, and it was kind of exemplified by a month before shooting. There was a section of the film where after Jonathan has been kicked out of Pine Street Inn for being out of control, he is out on the street, and I needed some sequences with De Niro walking around in the snow. And we were shooting in New York, about to shoot in New York, and you never know when it's going to snow. And a month before we were supposed to start shooting, I got a weather report that it was going to blizzard the next day. So I called De Niro up, and I said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And he said, "Why are you asking?" And I said, "Well, how do you feel about jumping in a car and getting whatever costume we have and going and shooting with me?" So very similar to a student film, I went out with Robert De Niro and a cameraman, and we hopped all around the city during this blizzard, largely in the financial district because I knew people would pay no attention to the camera or to Robert De Niro. They just wanted to get to work. And we shot something that was very integral to the film. And it happened to be Nick's birthday, Nick Flynn's birthday on that day, and he flew back that afternoon from Houston where he teaches. And arrived as we were doing our last stolen shot with De Niro.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the scenes where he's walking around, you know, and the snow is beginning to fall. It's a fresh snow. You can tell. You have a sense that, yeah, that it's like the first serious snowfall of a winter. And I think one of the things that the film really captures so vividly is the transition of somebody who's an alcoholic from being employed and functioning to somebody who is on the street, who, you know, loses a job, loses an apartment, and eventually accepts the fact that he is going to have to sleep outside tonight. Do you want to just kind of explain how you shot that and got that?
Actually, having the script for for so long and De Niro having the script for so long was really beneficial because literally you can be hopscotching between a scene from the end of the movie and the beginning of the movie, but everybody has to know exactly where they are in the character's journey. I felt like Bob locked down on the character in a way that was quite moving to me because I was very conscious of working with somebody who's one of the pillars of an art form on a character that was extremely complicated. And it was a huge benefit to me and to De Niro to have Nick around because Nick, we could look over at him and say, is this hogwash what we're doing? So Nick would give us very specific things such as how Bob ought to duct tape his sleeves to keep cold from getting in, or how he would go into a bus shelter and grab wads of toilet paper to stuff under the ears of his hat for added warmth. De Niro clearly worships some idea of reality or truth. Also, there was a very telling moment when De Niro and Nick and I went to visit Nick's dad in Boston. And when we sat down to meet him, the real Jonathan Flynn, as opposed to being at all intimidated by meeting Robert De Niro, looked over and said, so do you think you can pull this off? And Nick said, well, Dad, he's a very well-respected actor. He's in The Godfather, etc. And Jonathan said, yeah, I hear you're quite good, but are you going to be able to play me?
Wow.
And I kind of feel that that was license for Bob to pay due respect to this character's utter self-confidence. And it's a very odd irony that while Jonathan Flynn never had this masterpiece he was working on for decades published, he has now had a memoir written largely about him and is being played in a movie by Robert De Niro. So there's a point at which one can't tell whether his delusions have been born true or not.
Right. What was it? He kept saying, soon I will be known, and now
That's
he
right.
is. I thought we would hear, we have a little bit of sound of Jonathan Flynn, the real Jonathan Flynn. And this is from an episode of This American Life, which, you know, Nick Flynn, you participated in some years ago. And I know that Nick, you went and shot a lot of video of your father. And so this is from one of those videos. So I thought we would just hear a bit of this. This is, I believe the context here is that he's talking about himself, which I guess is probably his favorite subject. And he's listing places where he has been imprisoned, you know, and kind of comparing himself to other famous writers who wrote from prison. Again, Jonathan Flynn, let's listen.
Leavenworth, Lewisburg, Atlanta, Marion, Illinois, which was built to replace Alcatraz. I mean, I was there, and I had the pleasure, I mean, that pleasure of speaking as a Solzhenitsyn. I mean, I wanted to know what the I was writing about. I was thinking, Jesus, Solzhenitsyn's going to jump with envy when he sees this story. Because, well, he and Dostoevsky both wrote about their adventures in Russian prisons.
Yeah.
Heavily.
And that is Jonathan Flynn, the father of our guest, Nick Flynn. That tape comes to us courtesy of This American Life from WBEZ in Chicago. So, Nick, let's talk about your father actually becoming a client, or I guess a guest you would call him, at the Pine Street Homeless Center where you were working. You were aware at some point that he had lost his job, lost his place, and was on the street. Did you think he would show up there eventually?
That's one of the big questions of the book, whether when I began working at the shelter, even when I was 24, you know, even though my father wouldn't get evicted for three more years until I was 27, whether I went there for some deeper reason that was unknown to me, to be around men that were like him, that were sort of, you know, my father was always marginal and he probably had slept on people's couches a lot. He probably had slept in his cab on occasions. You know, he was an alcoholic and kind of wild and not that grounded. But I didn't go there on any conscious level. I didn't begin working there on any conscious level to meet my father. And so that's sort of the great cosmic joke is that, you know, even if I went to find people to be around men that were like my father, like you never expect actually the real father to show up. But then, you know, the movie, I think, you know, Paul's script in the movie, I think, you know, tracks it pretty well or accurately that one point I got a phone call that from my father, who I hadn't talked to in years, saying that he was getting evicted. And I went to meet him, and that's when I went to meet him, and we sort of have that in the film, you know, going to meet him in his apartment on Beacon Hill. And then helping him move his stuff into storage. And then, you know, some months later, he ends up coming through the doors. And I think, you know, once he got evicted, I'm sure it was in the back of my mind or somewhere. Maybe it was, I can't exactly remember, but maybe it was in the forefront of my mind that he could walk through the door at any moment. I don't think we put it in the film that in the middle, after 2 months or so, I actually saw him sleeping outside, and then maybe a couple months after that, he shows up at the shelter. So I sort of, you know, there were beats along the way that, you know, led him into the shelter.
Nick, I want to come back to that time when you were working at the shelter and your father came in as a client. And this was a time when you weren't in the best place. I mean, you were in your 20s. You know, your mom had committed suicide earlier. You were, you know, you were drinking, using drugs at times. And I wonder if when your father came into the shelter and if that had a different impact on the way you saw people who you served. I mean, I wondered if you didn't see yourself like those folks who were struggling, who were marginal, were on the street. But then when you saw your father in that position, did it, I don't know, connect you to your own problems in a different way?
You know, when he showed up, I think eventually I think I could sort of see it as a portent of what could happen if I continued drinking and using drugs, and that actually that I wasn't that far from the life that my father ended up living. But at the moment he came in, I think I had to, you know, shut down psychically and steel myself against this sort of this psychic devastation in some way to see your father, you know, on the streets. It's a very different thing to pick up someone you don't know from the streets and then to actually have other people pick your father up off the streets. It was, you know, psychically devastating. And so I think I just sort of steeled myself to it and did not identify with it and say like, oh, this will be me. You know, if I had, I think I probably would have quit drinking sooner, you know, rather than increasing my intake. That's sort of contradictory. It's a contradictory response to it, but that was my response.
So. You write that you could have offered him, you know, room at your place to stay overnight, tried to help him in a different way outside the shelter. Did you ever think of doing that?
Oh, I thought about it every day, every minute of every day. Sure. And I ended up doing it sort of what do they call it in therapy? Transference. I ended up having some other homeless people stay with me. And basically everyone I was hanging out with at that time in the building I lived in was, you know, extremely marginal. You know, we were not like, you know, the bar for our expectations in life was basically laying in the ground. I mean, I was surrounded by that. And so I brought other people in, other homeless people in. My friends were basically very marginal. And I thought every minute of every day that I could open the door to my father and let him in. But then I also thought, what would that do to me if I brought him in? He was a very dangerous, to me, psychically dangerous character. I felt, I think, that he could destroy me if I let him in too closely at that moment. And maybe it's true.
And destroy you in what way? By placing demands on you or what?
Oh, well, he was very slippery. I couldn't understand him, like who he was. I was probably terrified of being him. I didn't understand how he could say. I was also, you know, considering myself a writer, and here was a writer who was like calling himself a great writer who is now sleeping on the streets. So, you know, my sense of like what the future would hold for me was in at risk. And part of this is one of the reasons that I felt that Paul Dano was like the perfect person to play me, which is a strange thing to say, I guess. But, you know, one of the things is that he's the right age. I mean, beyond being this sort of fantastic actor, when one's in their 20s, I think one does still feel, at least I did, that one could be destroyed by your parents. It's sort of almost a mythic fear, archetypal fear. And it is possibly true in some circumstances. You know, I don't know if it's real for me. I don't know if my father actually would have destroyed him if I brought him in. But that was the feeling I had. By the time I was in my mid-30s, I actually could go to him and offer some help to him. But at that, you know, 10 years earlier, no.
Yeah. You know, another thing that's occurred to me, Nick Flynn, is that, you know, it was in the 80s when your father was in the homeless shelter. I mean, you were a different person then. You published the memoir in 2004, 2005, I guess. And you've continued to grow and mature and think about these events. You've become a father yourself. And I wonder if, when you look at your father now, is he a different guy than you saw in 2005?
Oh, yeah. Well, in 2005 or in 1987?
Well, in any of it. I mean, I'm just as you process these events, is your understanding differently? I mean, do you feel like if you were going to write that memoir now, it would be a very different story?
I think I sort of captured him. I feel like that book did capture who he was. And, you know, I returned to him in the following memoir, The Ticking is the Bomb. I pick up his life, you know, after being homeless. So, yeah, I mean, I think he has, you know, he's continued to grow. He was a little bit frozen in time because of the alcohol. He continued to drink when he was off the streets. He continued to drink daily. And only in the last, like, 4 years since he's now been – now, you know, I had to sort of relocate him into a long-term care facility about 4 years ago, which is where, you know, Paul and Mr. De Niro and I went and visited him. And only since then he's not – he doesn't drink. He doesn't drink. He's not on any – he was on some anti-anxiety medicine initially to try to get off the alcohol. And now he just is who he is, which is sort of an amazing thing. Now I actually get to see him – it seems like as a, you know, a full human being, and he's still just as complicated, still just as strange, still just as filled with sort of these sort of platitudes, which seem actually in retrospect kind of profound. You know, one of the themes of the film that Paul picked up on was this thing he wrote me when I was when he was first in prison, that we were put on this earth to help other people, which, you know, you can't really argue with. It's actually a beautiful sentiment. It becomes sort of ironic and twisted when he shows up at the shelter and says, well, I'm the person you should help. But that's just sort of one of the layers of the film that we sort of tried to tease out.
Now, Nick Flynn, you, of course, eventually stopped drinking, became a successful poet. You wrote this memoir, which was successful. You have another one out. But I wonder, earlier on, did you think of writing in some way as scary? I mean, maybe connected to your father's, I don't know, failure and self-delusion?
Yeah, writing for me was sort of the, since I was a child, was sort of the worst life choice you could make. I mean, to be a writer in my family, my father had always identified himself as a writer to my mother. When they met, he was writing this great novel. You know, before I was born, he was going to write this he was writing this masterpiece. There was no doubt about it. And so, you know, in part of why she, you know, left him was this delusion of greatness and identifying it very directly with being an artist. I mean, you know, we were not a family of artists with my mother and brother and I. That was not sort of a viable life choice. We were sort of, you know, I became an electrician after high school. But I always had this, you know, I had this thing in me to write. But it was always sort of a little shameful, it sort of meant you were, you know, like to say you were a poet was sort of saying you were kind of crazy. And I sort of carried that around for a long time. And I still kind of carry that a little bit. And I think it might be true, actually. As a life choice in this society, to say I am a poet is, you know, you might as well say you're Jesus Christ. It isn't exactly a respected life choice always. But that said, though, I think that's actually one of the reasons I continued with it, because I was able to do it in private and sort of under the radar for many years and feeling like I was maybe not doing even it was a disreputable thing to do. To be a writer was disreputable in some way. And I think that actually was some kind of fuel for me to continue writing.
Well, Paul Weitz, Nick Flynn, good luck with the film. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dave.
Nick Flynn's memoir has just been republished under the title Being Flynn, which is also the name of the new film starring Robert De Niro and directed by our other guest, Paul Weitz. In 1971, Theodore Seuss Geisel, best known as Dr. Seuss, published The Lorax, an explicit parable about the dangers posed by industrialization to the natural world. The new animated feature, Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, is written and directed by the team behind the 2010 film Despicable Me, and features the voices of Danny DeVito, Ed Helms, and Taylor Swift. It opens on the 108th anniversary of Geisel's birth. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
At the far end of town, where the grickle grass grows, and the wind smells slow and sour when it blows, and no birds ever sing, excepting old crows, is the street of the Lifted Lorax. Forgive me, it's such a joy to read Dr. Seuss aloud with those serpentine nonsense words flying out of your mouth as if on their own current. It's a shame there's no narration in the animated feature Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, and little in the way of verse. Early on, a character not in the book, Audrey, voiced by Taylor Swift, tells lovelorn 12-year-old Ted, voiced by Zac Efron, that once, nearby their now paved-over town, there were truffula trees, quote, and the touch of their tufts was much softer than silk, and they had the sweet smell of fresh butterfly milk. And Ted says, wow, what does that even mean? And Audrey says, I know, right? So one of the only lines that is from the book, that does have Dr. Seuss's sublime whimsy, is basically made fun of, or at least dragged down to earth. The directors and writers made The Delightful Despicable Me, and some of them made the last and much better Seuss feature, Horton Hears a Who. But this time, they don't seem to trust their material. And maybe they have reason. The book, The Lorax, tells the story in flashback of a young, energetic entrepreneur known as the Onceler, who grows rich by indiscriminately hacking down truffula trees and inadvertently wipes out an entire ecosystem. It's an environmentalist classic, a walloping argument against unchecked growth. But it's nowhere near Seuss's top tier. It doesn't have that thrilling mixture of anarchism and elegance. It's pure agitprop, with no surprises, and a title character, a mysterious creature who, quote, speaks for the trees, that even Theodore Geisel seems to find a pain, describing him as shortish and oldish, and brownish and mossy, who speaks with a voice that is sharpish and bossy. Fortunately, the Lorax doesn't appear in the book very much, and you don't actually have to hear his voice, as opposed to the movie, with its long and loud serenades in the unmellifluous New Jersey tones of Danny DeVito. Here, DeVito's Lorax protests the arrival by RV of the tacky relatives of the Onceler.
No, time out, back up, stop, don't move an inch. Nobody's moving in here. You gotta go, goodbye.
So who invited the giant furry peanut?
You calling me a peanut, huh? I'll go right up your nose!
Whoa! You wouldn't hit a woman.
That's a woman?
I don't blame DeVito. It's not as if he was hired for his subtlety. He's a good, pushy sitcom actor with expert timing. But given nonstop crass one-liners, he comes to embody the spirit of the movie in ways I don't think the filmmakers intend. The movie is broad and raucous and rather campy, and the songs, among them in ironic celebration of capitalism, barely pass muster. There are too many whack-a-mole sight gags featuring adorable barbalutes, bears to you, and three warbling fish. The screenwriters add a stock villain to the framing story, a pint-sized mogul who pollutes by design, since unbreathable air drives up sales of his canned air. He and his goons chase after 12-year-old Ted when the boy ventures into the denuded wasteland to talk to the aged, reclusive Onceler, not because the kid cares about the environment, but to impress the teenage Audrey. I guess that makes him easier to relate to than if he were just, you know, curious about why there are no animals and the landscape looks like the moon. Don't worry, this one isn't as eyeball-searing as the live-action The Cat in the Hat. The diaphanous texture of the truffula blooms is lovely, and the movie gets more compelling in the last 20 minutes, when the cute animals, not to mention the Lorax, take a hike. For a brief spell, it has the book's sense of loss, its droopy melancholy. You can still discern the stark parable beneath the movie's jokey, facetious tone. But this kind of studio 3D feature animation is all wrong for the material. The Lorax speaks for the trees, but I must speak for the Lorax.
David Edelstein is movie critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. After the break, we'll find out what goes into creating a New Yorker magazine cover with illustrator Barry Blitt. I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen back to Terry's recent interview with illustrator Barry Blitt. He's best known for his New Yorker magazine cover illustrations satirizing President Obama and George W. Bush. Barry Blitt won a Cover of the Year award from the American Society of Magazine Editors for his September 2005 cover of President Bush and his cabinet meeting in the Oval Office while Hurricane Katrina floodwaters rise around them. Recently, he illustrated the children's book written by Margaret McNamara called George Washington's Birthday. It follows the young George about his day, chopping down a cherry tree and fording a creek, as he worries that his family has forgotten his seventh birthday.
Barry Blitt, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I know you didn't write the book, you've illustrated it, but do you know why the premise is that it's George Washington's seventh birthday?
Well, I'm not inside the writer's head, but it seems to me it's a nice age to look at George Washington. He bears no resemblance to the severe and great man that we know him as, and he's young and he wants people to recognize his birthday. His family is going about the day as if it isn't his birthday, and he learns some important lessons about dwelling on stuff like that. And it's sort of an interesting way of seeing him.
So how did you figure out how to draw George Washington as a little child? And I should mention he's like this little kid with a powdered wig that he hangs on his chair at night.
Right. I mean, a big premise of the book is that we deal in the myths that are told about George Washington, and then there's like a disclaimer on each page, you know, saying this didn't really happen. And one of those disclaimers is that he actually didn't wear a wig. But it was more fun to depict him that way and hard to resist. Obviously, developing the character of young George, I drew him several different ways, and it was nice to have him frowning as he usually is when you see him depicted, but, you know, in later paintings of his life. But ultimately, I mean, he just looks like a normal child in the book.
He's also wearing one of those jackets. I tried to figure out what they're called, but I really don't know. It's one of those jackets that in front buttons to the waist, but in back there's kind of like tails.
Right, yeah. You won't get the answer from me, unfortunately.
Okay, I thought you might know.
I mean, are you getting the feeling here that I fudged it?
No,
Because I actively fudged it, basically. But, you know, I mean, there aren't pictures of him then, so, you know, no one's the wiser.
So what were you taught about George Washington when you were a child, and did you care?
Well, first of all, I'm Canadian.
Oh,
so,
right.
So you want to start the interview over, maybe?
No, I'm not even going to do it.
Okay,
I don't think we should do it. So is it wildly inappropriate and terribly wrong for the author of this book to have asked you, a Canadian, to illustrate a George Washington book?
I ask myself that every day. But the truth is I'm sort of getting pigeonholed. I mean, first of all, there was a lot of Canadian illustrators working in the States. So
infiltrating the States.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
They walk among us. But this isn't the first and it's not the last sort of book about Americana that I've done. My last children's book was about Mark Twain that I illustrated, and I'm working on one about the Founding Fathers. So you better get used to it, I'm afraid.
Okay. So you not only have this new George Washington's birthday book, you've done a bunch of presidential covers for the New Yorker magazine, satirical illustrations. Most recently you did one of President Obama watching the Super Bowl, and he's sitting in his chair with, I think it's a beer, a bowl of potato chips next to him, watching this big flat screen TV of the Super Bowl. But the Super Bowl is actually Mitt Romney tackling Newt Gingrich.
That's right, yes. What would you like me to tell you about that one?
The genesis of the idea, how you came up with it.
The genesis of the idea basically was the art director, Francoise, calling me in sort of at the last minute, wondering if I had any ideas, political ideas, but also to keep in mind it was Super Bowl week, and Gingrich and Romney were beating each other up then. Remember when it was a two-man race? And it just seemed to make sense to put them on the screen. First, I think as far as the genesis of the idea, it was just them on a football field, you know, tackling each other, beating the crap out of each other. And then it seemed like a funny idea to remove and pull back and have Obama watching the game smiling, you know, at his good fortune, at his team winning, basically, or his team ahead in any case.
So what kind of reaction did you get to that?
It was a little bit of a suck-up, I'm afraid, that particular cover. It was sort of cheering for Obama, and you don't always want to be cheering for one side. I mean, you never want to be cheering, really, if you're a political cartoonist. But so There were a lot of positive comments on Huffington Post about it, for instance, and I felt the sting of negative comments on the Huffington Post before. So, but, you know, I personally wasn't crazy about the drawing. It was done at the last minute, as those often are topical covers for The New Yorker. So, I mean, I cringe over most of the things I turn in, whether they're kids' books or illustrations in magazines. So I have to learn to live with that.
Do I sense a self-esteem issue?
Yes.
Let me ask you about what was probably your most controversial New Yorker cover political cartoon. And that was the one from July of 2008, the fist bump cartoon. So this is candidate Obama and Michelle are giving each other the fist bump. And he's dressed in a robe and turban. Her hair is in a big afro, and she has a rifle. Is it an AK-47?
I still don't remember this one, which you'll have to keep describing it. That was a joke.
Yes.
She's got. I think she's got an AK-47. She's dressed like a panther, perhaps, like Angela Davis, maybe.
And she has a bullet belt, too, strapped around her back. Meanwhile, the American flag is burning in the fireplace, and there's a picture of bin Laden on the wall. And I think the intention here was to draw the Obamas as the right wing was trying to describe them. She's a secret black radical. He's a secret Muslim. And they both want to destroy the country.
Exactly.
A lot of people misinterpreted this. A lot of people were, like, really angry at this cartoon. And they were thinking, people are going to see this. They're not going to look at it carefully enough to realize it's a satire of a far-right stereotype, and they're going to think that this is proving that she's like a guerrilla fighter and he is a radical Muslim, and they're both intent on destroying the country. What was your reaction to the people who condemned you for that?
Well, you know, anytime I produce a cover, I always regret it afterwards. So I sort of agreed with them. I mean, even to this day, I'm not sure if that was the worst thing I've ever done, or I know it wasn't the best thing I've ever done, but I'm still ambivalent about it. It was obviously taking a chance. It was, I mean, the intention going in was trying something different and something interesting. I mean, there was all this stuff in the ether, you know, on the radio waves and on Fox, and everywhere you went, you heard these descriptions of this guy. Of the president being, you know, being a secret terrorist Muslim, and it just seemed funny to draw it all out, to put it all on a piece of paper. And I brought the artwork into the New Yorker myself because it was really a last minute thing. And I stood there with Francoise, the art director, and we sort of held it up. It was like a scene in Citizen Kane, where, you know, this is going to change everything. This is the one they'll remember. This will, you know. No one will call him a Muslim again after this, which obviously was ridiculous. I mean, part of it was the time that it came out. You know, people were nervous, and there was so much hope behind Obama becoming president. And, you know, I guess there was some, you know, underlying hysteria that a cartoon could change those fortunes and imperil that possibility. So, but luckily, you know, it faded quickly.
What was your reaction to the people who thought that the cartoon would actually prove, in some people's minds, reinforce the stereotype instead of laughing at it?
Yeah, I mean, the magazine comes out on a Monday, but it's sort of leaked to the press I think it goes out to the press on Sunday evening. So Sunday evening, I immediately started getting a lot of emails. I think it was the Huffington Post got a hold of it and some other websites, and it was just all over the place on the internet. And I was started to get, you know, emails, personal emails to me from very, very angry people. And my reaction was to try and answer all of them. And so I would answer each email personally saying, it was obviously satire. Look at the ridiculousness of it. I wasn't obviously, you know, this isn't how I feel, and no one could take this seriously. But then, you know, then there were thousands of emails, and I couldn't answer all of them. And so my reaction was, it was kind of horrifying, basically, for Monday and Tuesday. You know, my mother called me screaming, "What did you do?"
Oh, no.
Yeah, the tide changed probably by the middle of that week, and I leading a sort of a normal life since then.
So the White House was very critical of your fist bump cover cartoon for The New Yorker, but later President Obama asked for an autographed copy of one of your cartoons. Which one was it?
It was a drawing I did shortly after healthcare was passed. Healthcare was passed, right? And it was a drawing of an elephant, you know, in a hospital robe, sitting in a doctor's room, and a donkey is a Democrat. The Democrat donkey is behind him. He's the doctor, and he's slipping on his glove. He's going to give him a rectal exam. And I did a drawing of that. I mean, we made a print of that for the president.
And then you had a cover illustration of President Obama, I think it was on the cover, walking on water, but then it's several panels, and then in the final panel, he's kind of sinking into the water?
That's right, yeah. He was looking kind of vulnerable then.
What? And, yeah.
And so, you know, it seemed only right to let everyone know that we didn't believe he could walk on water, and that's okay.
So what's the editorial process like at The New Yorker when it comes to covers? Like, do your covers have to be in political agreement with the, like, editorial staff of the magazine? I have an idea of what, like, fact-checking and editing is like for a written piece, but what's the process like for a political cartoon, for a satirical cartoon?
I think they're looking for good ideas. There isn't any – I mean, we've done anti-Obama covers. But if you're asking about the process, as I mentioned, the art editor, Françoise Mouly, sends out a calendar, you know, there's a sort of a regular stable of artists who contribute covers and illustrations. And often it'll have dates on it, you know, Valentine's Day is still open, it'll say, or Purim, and there isn't a Purim cover yet. And then, you know, people will send in ideas for those days, and they're always open to topical covers. Sometimes I will get a phone call, and I'd imagine other people will too at the same time, saying, you know, it would be great to do something about, you know, about Santorum, say, you know, rising in the polls or something. And then you send stuff in, and as it does go to press a week before, it's often it comes down to doing it, you know, the Thursday of the week, and if it's decided on the Wednesday, you really have to scramble to put something down on paper. And that sort of thing does suit me, actually, because I'll just redraw things a million times. I'm never happy with what I've done, and also I'll draw it once and think I can do a better job of it. I'll draw it again, and I'll go back to the first one and say that was a little bit better, and then start a third one. And so it's nice to have someone come and actually take it away from me. Usually a courier is sent and waits outside the door, and they just pull it away from me.
Is it true?
There's not really pulling, but they're there, and I have to give them something.
So you're doing both children's books and New Yorker covers. Do they draw on different parts of your brain?
Yeah, completely. I mean, children's books are a marathon. It's against my nature. And New Yorker cover is a perfect thing for me. I can just, you know, it's as intense as it is for one day or maybe 2 days. You know, it ultimately gets taken away from you quickly. But a children's book is, you know, it'll go on for months. And if you've got a character, you've got to imagine him from all sides and be able to, you know, make him look the same on every page. And it's really a job for someone with a greater attention span than I have.
What materials do you use for your drawings, like for the cover illustrations for The New Yorker?
So many people are putting their drawings together on the computer and with Photoshop and stuff, and there are so many advantages to that. I mean, I'm using pen and ink basically. I'm like a scrivener. It's harder to find nibs that I like. It really makes me feel old. And a lot of the inks that I liked are like discontinued. You know, God knows what was in them. But you know, I use India ink and I, you know, scratch a drawing onto a piece of watercolor paper and then color it in. And a lot of my contemporaries will, you know, they'll do a drawing one way or another and then scan it and put the colors in that way and change the colors. And that would be a great thing to do, to be able to, you know, after you've painted something and it looks terrible, to be able to change the color on something. And, you know, maybe one day, but I don't adapt very easily. But we'll see.
Why else have you resisted? What do you like about the pen and ink Scrivener approach?
What do I like about it? I didn't say I liked it. It's just what I'm doing. It's just what I'm doing now. I mean, it's, you know, it's a number of people have tried to, you know, sit me down and teach me how to use Photoshop, and it's just my eyes glaze over. It does feel kind of mechanical, and I guess there's something, there is a certain amount of control that you have with pen and ink. I don't know. That's a really unsatisfactory answer, but it's, you know, it's what I'm using now. When it works out, it's really nice, but I can't remember the last time it worked out.
So in addition to your New Yorker cartoons, you know, you do the books for children. Do you have children? Do they read your books? Are you a star among your children and your children's friends?
Well, that actually, that you mentioned that, it reminds me of a story. I took my son Sam to a movie recently. I was dropping him off to meet a bunch of friends there. So I dropped him off, and a bunch of his little friends were there, and he was like, didn't want me to come anywhere near them. He wanted me to drop him off and not say hi to his friends. And I was like offended. I said, well, you know, I'm just going to say hi to them. And he said, he basically, I guess I was just too uncool for him. And like I said, but I did the cover of the New Yorker last week. But he that didn't change his mind.
How old is your son?
He's 41. Sorry, he's 15.
Oh, so I don't know how you get around that. There just seems to be that moment when parents are an embarrassment to their children, no matter.
I know it was awful.
No matter how famous you are, you know.
Well, or not, but yeah. I mean, I left him and we text to each other. I just wrote you. I texted him, and he wrote back, "I'm sorry, dude." So. We understand each other.
Illustrator Barry Blitt speaking with Terry Gross. Blitt has contributed more than 40 covers to The New Yorker. Recently, he illustrated the children's book, George Washington's Birthday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. You can follow the tweets of our associate producer for online media, Melody Kramer, at NPR Fresh Air. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air Weekend.